Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The Palestinian Ministry of Health in the Gaza Strip has confirmed that the Zionist regime forces have killed all members of over 600 families, removing them entirely from the Palestinian civil registry. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Palestine Chronicle wrote, Gaza resident Abdulrahman al-Shatli said in an interview with the Palestine Chronicle that the Zionist regime forces killed all members of his nephew Mahmoud al-Shatli's family through the shelling of the family's home in the Nusayrat refugee camp in central Gaza. Al-Shatli explained that his nephew Mahmoud, along with Mahmoud's wife and their four children, were killed while taking shelter at his wife's family home. Al-Shatli said that the home was densely populated with women, children, and civilians. The Zionist regime army intentionally targeted the house, causing a high number of casualties. Al-Shatli continued, "My nephew's family was joined by hundreds of Palestinian families who have completely disappeared during this aggression. There is no one left from Mahmoud's family. Consequently, my nephew's family was removed from the civil registry and transferred to the registry of martyrs." In the same text, Gaza resident Muhammad al-Assar told the Palestine Chronicle that the Zionist regime forces killed all members of his uncles and cousins' families. He said, "The occupation killed all the members of my uncles, Dr. Abdulrahman Al-Hur, and the elderly Sheikh Ziad Al-Hur, along with all the members of their families and grandchildren." Al-Assar added, "All the members of my cousin, Muhammad Al-Hur's family, were killed, as well as all the members of my cousin, Tariq Al-Hur's family, and my cousin, Ziad Al-Hur's family. They all took refuge together from the rockets at my uncle, Dr. Abdulrahman's house. But Israel's bombs reached them, killing all of them. They were all civilians with no affiliation to any Palestinian organization." Gaza resident Safa Nufal told the Palestine Chronicle that the Israeli regime army killed all members of her uncle, Dr. Amin Nufal's family. "It was a massacre that claimed the lives of dozens of women and children." Nufal explained, "We lost all the members of my uncle Amin's family, and we lost all the members of his son's families. All of them were killed in an Israeli regime airstrike on their house in the village of Zawaida, which has caused us immense tragedy and indescribable shock." Nufal continued, "My uncle Amin Muhammad Nufal, his wife Tamam Yusuf Nufal, and their children, Mu'tasim, Mu'min, Maisara and Amal were killed, and their sons Mu'adh and Mustafa were severely injured. The families of Mu'tasim, his wife Ahmad, Ali, Amina, and Fatima, Mu'min, his wife Islam, Mahmoud, and Anas, Maisara, his wife, and Shayma, Muhammad's sons Amin, Hamza, and Ahmad, and Mu'adh's daughter, the child Mayas, as well as Mustafa's sons Muhammad, Amro, Mahmoud, Tamam, Amin, and the one-day-old Omar were all killed, she explained. Ibrahim Musa is a resident of the Nusayrat refugee camp. He explained that Israeli regime forces killed all the members of his neighbor's family, the Al-Naghla family. Ibrahim issued an urgent appeal to all free people around the world to stand with the Palestinian people, put an end to the Zionist regime's crimes. The fabricated regime of Israel's ongoing larger-scale aggression on Gaza has already led to thousands of killed, wounded and missing persons, as well as the destruction of thousands of buildings and housing units, and the displacement of more than a million people to the southern areas of the Gaza Strip. Meanwhile, the website of the New Arab wrote, as the brutal Israeli regime attack against Palestinian civilians continues in Gaza, scores of mass graves are buried there, with entire families being wiped out of the civil registry. The Gaza Strip's health ministry said the death toll from the Zionist regime's relentless bombardment has reached 8,525, including 3,542 children and 2,187 women. Furthermore, the number of children killed in nearly a month of the Zionist regime bombing has now exceeded the number killed annually in all the world's conflict zones since 2019. Palestinians say this war is robbing them not only of their loved ones, but also of their funeral rites. The Zionist regime's strikes have killed so many people so quickly that they have overwhelmed hospitals and morgues, making the normal rituals of death all but impossible.
Hi, and welcome to this edition of Gaza Under Attack. I'm Saeed Pourreza, coming to you from the British capital. With me here in the studio to discuss and unpack all of that, broadcaster and political analyst Tere Kofi, Dr. Abu Salama. And joining us on Skype is Ali Salam. He's the editor-in-chief of Basira Press. He is in Moscow at the moment, but is normally based in Tehran. Good to have with us, Dr. Shad. What do you think of the way the media have covered this war? You know, the choice of words such as died for Palestinians, killed for Israelis, the line of questioning. What do you think of it all?
It's definitely ideological. All of these ideological constructions are designed to to demonize the Palestinians and to generate legitimacy for a genocide and an ethnic cleansing campaign being committed in full view on live TV. It's not surprising for us. And it's not surprising for us to hear such words being chosen to describe the Palestinians. I'm sorry.
This is a good opportunity to segue into the online conversation. We were hearing Dr. Abu Salama earlier say that the way the media here have covered this story was to basically lay the groundwork for what it turned out to be a genocide against the Palestinians.
Right.
What do you make of that?
Well, I think it's going to be counterproductive because with the media top cover to try and paint the Palestinians as terrorists, basically, who deserved what they were getting, I think that the backlash in terms of the demonstrations that have taken place have demonstrated that it hasn't worked. And actually, the more the Palestinian rights are disregarded, the more likely it is that the public will form a hardened view against Israel. And I think that that is in progress right now as we sit here. Most of us in our lifetimes have never witnessed anything like this. Not on the basis where we're seeing it on our televisions every single day. And I think it's quite obvious to the average fair-minded person that there are two standards being applied here, as the lady said, is that on the one hand, you have a certain level of respect for Israeli life, and on the other hand, you have complete and utter contempt for those in Palestine who are being starved even of medicines.
And Dr. Abu Salama, do you also think that there has been a shift in public opinion, an increase in awareness among members of the public of who the oppressor here is and who the oppressed is, despite the support that the Israelis have received materially and politically and diplomatically from the United States all the way to the Western countries in decades?
I think the popular support for Palestine has been growing steadily for the past decades, and Israel has really lost in terms of grassroots, in terms of narrative, and that's why they are seeking politicians such as Biden and Sunak and mainstream media to be mouthpieces for their crimes. But the people who have made it to the streets of London, the streets of Istanbul, all over, this has been a very difficult period. And with all the sleepless nights and my feeling of guilt to eat while my family is hungry is has completely affected my immune system. So it's the people, I believe that the people are on the side of the Palestinians. The majority of humanity are on the side of the Palestinians. And those that are acting as mouthpieces for genocide are going to be held to account. And history will judge them the same way history judged those who were complicit in South Africa apartheid and other atrocities around the world. We are witnessing unprecedented genocide happening in front of our eyes, and we are unable. They have family there. Some of them have been buried in under the rubble of their own homes. My cousins and their children 5 of them have been dead while asleep. They've been killed while sleeping. Israel bombed their homes at 1 a.m.
Absolutely. It's impossible not to be overwhelmed by emotion when we're inundated by images of children, women, and others being basically incinerated, body parts being torn off as a result of these massive bombs dropped on them 24/7 by the Israeli military.
That's right. And as your guest has said, Israel is trying to target every means of survival for the people of Gaza. My mom had such a close encounter with murder as she was going to get bread for our starving family. They are using the weapons of starvation, of thirst, against a whole population. In Gaza, more than half of them are children. This is genocide, and there is no justification for such crimes. There is no justification for this long-standing injustice that has been befalling the Palestinians over and over again. We, if the world has a short-term memory that brings the context back to the 7th of October, we remember, our bodies remember. We will not forget.
Yeah, I'm sorry to interrupt you there. I just want to quickly get Teta's thoughts here, too. Teta, I felt like you were just about to say something.
Well, absolutely. I mean, what she's saying is heartrending. But more than this, it's that people are listening and hearing what... This isn't the first time the Palestinians have been through horrific experiences. But on account of a series of events which have taken place, starting with the pandemic, going on into the Ukraine war, and the downstream impacts that's had on the quality and the standard of living for people in Europe, I'm beginning to observe that actually people in these countries, which are very influential, are beginning to start to feel more empathetic towards people who are living in far more desperate circumstances. Mm-hmm. And this is something, it seems, that the people who are playing from the playbook of yesteryear haven't factored in. These demonstrations are only the beginning of a new wave of empathy and global understanding for those who are being abused.
It's a very apt point, Ted. Thank you very much. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres was on a whistle-stop tour of Nepal, but the issue of the bombardment of Gaza was not far behind. Here's what he had to say.
The situation in Gaza is growing more desperate by the hour. I regret that instead of a critically needed humanitarian pause supported by the international community, Israel has intensified its military operations. The number of civilians who have been killed and injured is totally unacceptable. All parties must respect their obligations under international humanitarian law. That law emerged from the tragedy and awful experiences of war. I've always been consistent in my call for strict compliance of the well-established principles and rule of international humanitarian law. The protection of civilians is paramount. The laws of war establish clear rules to protect human life and respect humanitarian concerns. Those laws cannot be contorted for the sake of expedience. The world is witnessing a humanitarian catastrophe taking place before our eyes. More than 2 million people with nowhere safe to go are being denied the essentials for life, food, water, shelter, and medical care. while being subjected to relentless bombardment. I urge all those with responsibility to step back from the brink. And I reiterate my appeal for an immediate humanitarian ceasefire, the unconditional release of all hostages, and the delivery of a sustained humanitarian relief at a scale that meets the needs of the people of Gaza. We must join forces to end this nightmare for the people of Gaza, Israel, and all those affected around the world, including here in Nepal.
Words that have so far fallen on deaf ears. Fahima Mohammed is back here in the studio with me with the second helping of Palestine in the News. Fahima, what do you have to share with us?
Well, we do have quite a few names fighting on the mainstream, trying to put their narratives out on behalf of Palestinian people and what's happening in the situation. We have James Schneider, who is, well, obviously before this, we discussed this before with the actual news, having a sort of like hate mob sort of like attitude, calling all the Palestinian sort of protests that are out there as being jihadi mobs, and obviously blanketing all of them under one umbrella, and sort of, you know, calling for it to be a threat than a demonstration. And as you've said, you've been there and so many other people, and we've shown footage as well to show that there was such a diversity of people coming together. So for this to be out there, it's just clearly insightful, it's Islamophobic, and it's obviously sending a message which is actually very, very harsh and really, really powerful against the Muslims.
We have the James Schneider one.
Yes, the James Schneider one, which I'm talking about. He's been fighting, you know, trying to get his point out there to even sort of like debating for endorsing, you know, of war crimes and showing that this is definitely not right, and putting forward the history, educating and making people aware of the situation, that it didn't just start on the 7th of October, and, you know, really having a platform and speaking very, very loudly on these issues, as we see here on GB News.
And at the same time, calling for an immediate ceasefire.
Absolutely.
Reflecting, echoing what people have been saying in the streets and online as well.
No, it doesn't. Please let me answer. It's entirely appropriate. I'm very proud that we had 500,000 people on the streets of London yesterday calling for a ceasefire. That was what that protest was about. And it's probably the largest protests we've seen on the streets of London since those that opposed the Iraq War in 2003. The overwhelming majority of British people want to see a ceasefire, and they're raising their voice because that is the morally justified position.
Okay.
And any attempts, and there have been many, many attempts, to characterise...
Well, you can see the treatment.
Yeah,
you can see the treatment of even they allowing it, because obviously the regulations have to show, you know, an, a sort of equal debate, a balance. But the treatment of people that are even coming and speaking on behalf of the Palestinians is so different to anyone on the opposing side. And you see that again and again and again on the mainstream media. And also, but he's done really well to sort of like, you know, educate and bring about awareness, even though he's interrupted, disrupted, you know, and not actually been given a chance.
Across.
Exactly. And here we have, obviously, the commemoration and memory of the journalists that have been killed. And journalists, remember, with, you know, clear press
vests
on, and so many have been killed. Their families have been placed in sort of so-called safe sort of, you know, settlement, and even they have been bombed. So again, we have a lot of that happening. And then we have Zahra Mohammed, who is the head of the Muslim Council, sort of talking about the Central Oxford Mosque, about the Islamophobia attacks, as this particular case was when a petrol can with the words IDF rule was on there, thrown at the gate of the mosque, showing again Islamophobic
You get a lot of
acts.
Coverage. Of
a lot of coverage.
Anti-Semitic attacks.
Yes,
but
not on the Islamophobia. And again, we've got the death toll as if we speak, and obviously it's going to surpass, as we're talking at this very moment in time, past 8,000, mainly women and minors. And obviously you've got the statistics to show that it's ever increasing by the minute.
And because, again, it excludes the number of people who are still caught under rubble.
Yes.
That will
yes.
push the number of the dead.
Absolutely.
The
We're
going to
see much
higher.
More as we unfold.
Fahima, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
We'll have more from you next, of course. Many thanks. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has been one of the first leaders to stridently condemn Israeli actions. In a speech over the weekend, the Turkish president made the following pronouncement.
Frankly, Israel has been committing war crimes for 22 days. Now, Israel, we will proclaim you as a war criminal to the world, and we are making our preparations for this. The West has the biggest responsibility for the massacre in Gaza, because Israel would not be able to take a step without them. If it did, it would not survive 3 days. It would collapse.
Here in the studio again with me, Teddy Kofi, a journalist and political commentator, and on via Skype, Palestinian-born activist, Dr. Shad Abu Salama. Thank you both for staying with us. I'll start with you, Ted. Your reaction to what President Erdogan had to say.
Well, it's absolutely obvious. Israel could not do what it does without the support of its principal ally, which is the United States of America. And until the people who support Israel to give it the backbone to take such draconian steps pull back their support, Israel will continue to act in this way. And it's a pity, because this conflagration has the capacity for drawing more and more people into the conflict.
And with those words, we come to the end of the show. I'd like to thank my guests, Teddy Kofi, Ali Salam, and Dr. Shad Abu Salama, and you, of course, for tuning in. Until next time, goodbye.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. In the limelight.
Palestinian children and adults are getting sick all the time with diarrhea, vomiting, and fever because of lack of clean water and unsanitary conditions following the Zionist regime's recent attacks on the Gaza Strip. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote, in a tent set up in the playground of Deir al-Balah School for Girls in Gaza, the Abu Owaili family took refuge from the Zionist regime's bombardment of their neighborhood. The Palestinian family is like tens of thousands of other families who fled their homes in northern Gaza Strip and Gaza City and are currently scattered in schools run by the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, UNRWA, in the southern part of the besieged enclave. According to healthcare professionals providing support to the internally displaced persons, IDPs, in the schools, epidemics are spreading fast due to lack of clean water, medicine, and hygiene products. Wael Abu Owaili, a former resident of Gaza City, told Middle East Eye, "We have been displaced twice since the beginning of the war. We first fled to the Gaza school for boys in Gaza City before the Israelis dropped leaflets telling us to evacuate. We took a taxi and had to pay him 200 shekels to flee this school." He added, "Since we came there, we have been getting sick all the time. We are suffering from diarrhea, vomiting, and fever. And it is not just us. Almost everyone here suffers the same symptoms. They mostly give us paracetamol, and it is not enough." The 26-year-old father is staying along with 24 members of his family, including his mother, brothers, sisters, and their children, in a 2x3-quarter-meter tent behind the school's main building. "If our health condition worsens, they sometimes give us antibiotics, and we have to secure the rest of the medicines ourselves," he told the Middle East Eye. "I used to sell vegetables, but since the beginning of this war, I haven't been able to work and thus don't have any money." Of the over 8,000 people taking refuge in the Deir al-Balah school in the central Gaza Strip, epidemics have spread among at least 90%, according to doctors working there. The most common and fast-spreading diseases that are turning into epidemics in accommodation centers are gastroenteritis, scabies, and chickenpox, doctors told MEE. Abir Salem, a volunteer nurse at Deir al-Balah School, told MEE, "Almost everyone here has a gastroenteritis, accompanied by diarrhea, vomiting, fever, and a sore throat. This is an expected result of the disastrous conditions in the IDP accommodation centers." She added, "Water is not always available, and when it's available, it's not clean. There are no hygiene products. Mothers here would love to keep their children clean and healthy, but where do they get these products? Every day my colleague and I check on the families here, and in all the classrooms we enter, there are dozens of people, mainly children, suffering from these symptoms. Once we enter the classroom, all mothers ask for diapers because their children suffer from diarrhea and need to change their diapers around 6 to 7 times. We don't have enough diapers to cover the needs of all families, so we give each mother a few ones each day." Salem added that IDPs seeking refuge outside the school also come to ask for medicine and diapers as they flood their homes without enough money. "The majority of children," she says, "are wetting their clothes because of the trauma and the cold," she explained. "It gets very cold at night. People sleep on the floor and don't have enough blankets," she continued. "Many children in each classroom are wetting their clothes. A few days ago, a mother came telling me she herself is wetting her clothes. You can't imagine that all of these people are wetting their clothes and blankets several times a day, and there are not enough hygiene products to clean them. The epidemics are spreading very quickly." According to Salem, around 30 to 50 people stay in each classroom, and such cramped conditions enable the spread of the disease. But what is more dangerous is that some pregnant women were forced to give birth inside the accommodation centers, including the schools, while ambulances could not reach them as the bombardment continues. 7 months pregnant, Asmahan Altoum, who fled her home in the northern Gaza Strip, says she's terrified that she might be forced to give birth in one of the school's classrooms. She said, "My home was bombed, and I came here along with my husband and two children since the first day of the war. As a pregnant woman, I used to take vitamins and other supplements. Here, I haven't been able to have any of those. I cannot even find a mattress to sleep on. I sleep on the sand. Even the water is not clean. Every time I drink water, I get sick and suffer from diarrhea and fever. Can you imagine having a fetus inside your belly and only getting to eat less than one loaf with a small amount of canned meat a day?" Healthcare professionals in the school receive daily reports from other accommodation centers, including UNRWA-run schools, about new diseases spreading among the displaced people. The potential for disease is exacerbated by the Zionist regime's targeting of schools across the strip, eventually forcing increasing numbers of IDPs into the remaining crowded buildings. According to Al Jazeera English, severe overcrowding, a lack of privacy, and inadequate sanitation have put these schools at risk of a prolonged and severe public health crisis, adding pressure to the already overloaded healthcare system, which doctors and the health ministry describe as being in a state of total collapse. The displaced people in these schools have also lacked access to life necessities such as water, electricity, food, milk, nappies, and essential supplies.
Back to Aperture, everyone. In the first part of the documentary, we met the hidden victims of America's multi-billion dollar chemical industry. By offering an excellent wage and a comfortable retirement package, chemical giants Dow Chemical and DuPont factories are welcome wherever they go. For many of the town's residents, a job at Dow Chemical or DuPont marks the beginning of a very glimmering future. Yet, victims like Alice, Kenton, and Rukna have seen the ugly truth behind this prosperity. Don't go away. Here's the rest of our program.
850 children are now registered at Rashida B's center. In 2015, Dow gave $4.5 billion to its shareholders, but not a single cent has been given to the decontamination of Bhopal. For weeks, we tried to reach the communications department at Dow to get an interview, without success.
The water that people drink. Who's going to answer those questions? It's really important.
I'm not aware of who that is right off the top of my head. We have 50,000 employees, so I'll have to do some research.
Dow never called us back, so we decided to go to the company's General Assembly in Midland, in the U.S., to ask our questions. A few days later, we finally received an email from Dow. The company laments, "Bhopal was a terrible tragedy that we will never forget." But they relieved themselves of all responsibility, stating that, "We acquired Union Carbide more than 16 years after the catastrophe of 1984.
Dow continues to address global issues through human solutions. Issues like clean water, as important as life itself. Dow is working to make water safe and readily available to people all over the globe. The human element. Nothing is more fundamental. Nothing more elemental.
In Dow's wake, countless victims and human tragedies pile up without any damage to the company's profits. In December 2015, Dow announced the biggest financial operation in its history. A merger of $130 billion with another American chemical giant, DuPont. A match made in heaven.
You and DuPont, there's a lot of good chemistry between us.
DuPont made its fortune with dynamite.
Dynamite!
Nylon. And Teflon. The magical material that prevents food from sticking to pans. However, behind the success of Teflon, DuPont hides a dark secret.
I just can't believe the DuPont, the money means more than people. There's people dying because of what they've done.
DuPont knew years ago what they were doing.
At best, it's despicable. And at the worst, it's criminal.
At the heart of this drama is one city, Parkersburg. Lost in the eastern U.S. The city was built around the DuPont factory. Suzanne Bailey came here in 1978 to work on the Teflon production lines.
I went to work in May the 8th, 1978. That was my glorious day. That was the elite job. I mean, everybody wanted to go there because of, for the money, for the benefits and everything like that. It was secure.
The chemical industry is a growing one, growing by leaps and bounds.
I mean, you could just mention the DuPont name and doors swung open. It was like princes coming through the door, you know?
Yes, in such an environment, you can look to a bright future with confidence and optimism.
Were you happy, so?
I was thrilled. I was absolutely thrilled to death.
A few months after starting her job at DuPont, Suzanne Bailey became pregnant. In January of 1981, she gives birth to little Bucky.
When he was born, it was very traumatic. They didn't know what to do with him. They'd never seen anything like it. I could not figure out what happened. He had half a nostril, half a nose. The eye is a keyhole pupil. I didn't know what to do. I was afraid he was going to die in my arms. I had no idea what was wrong.
Bucky survived. He is now 35 years old. But his childhood was spent between his home and the hospital.
I had 30 surgeries in a span of, you know, 6 to 7 years, where they took rib cartilage to form my nose. I have a metal plate here. They stretched my forehead out so that they could use that skin and bring it down and mold my nose here. I still only have one nostril, functioning nostril.
We had to put the hockey mask on him and the guards because he wasn't allowed to touch his face.
How long?
He had to wear those for, I would say, 3 months, 4 months.
It's a long time.
Yeah, the only way that he got to take him off was just to eat.
How is it as a kid to grow up and to have, you know, so many surgeries? And I mean, it's pretty intense, you know.
Walking out in public and going into a store or a restaurant, and as soon as you enter, all the eyes are on you. And school, when you go in and you're trying to make new friends, All they see is you're different.
After her maternity leave, Suzanne Bailey began to suspect her job as the cause of Bucky's deformities. A mysterious source tips her off to one molecule in particular, C8, the molecule in Teflon that stops food from sticking to pans.
When I went back to work the first day, I went to the locker and I found the paper laying there. I picked it up and I began reading about it. It was talking about how the rats were fed the C8 and what deformities that it had around their face. And I thought, that sounds just like Bucky.
It was very similar to what Bucky had.
Absolutely. Very similar, almost identical to what he had. That's why I knew that there was something wrong. That's why I connect.
The scientific study Suzanne Bailey found had been conducted by a subcontractor of DuPont. It studied baby rats whose mothers were exposed to C8. They developed abnormal eye lenses.
I immediately walked out that door, went down to medical, and I said, is this what's wrong with my baby? Oh, no, no, no. Nothing on this planet will hurt you. That was the motto. That's what they always say.
Yeah.
Nothing here will hurt you.
But in the meantime, DuPont was secretly investigating the pregnant women working in their factory. 2 out of 7 children born to the factory workers had facial deformities like Bucky. Shortly after, DuPont decided to transfer Suzanne Bailey and her colleagues to other departments. At the time, Kenton Wamsley also worked in the manufacturing department of Teflon. He remembers the discussion he had with his manager.
He said, Ken, we sent all the women home out of Teflon, all of them. He said, oh, don't worry. It won't hurt the men, just the women. We feel that it can cause trouble. So I thought, won't hurt me.
Kenton Wamsley was a lab technician. He handled C8 for 30 years.
Breathe the fumes from them, all the samples we breathe. But we just, you know, at the time, we thought DuPont would take care of us. And so I just did my jobs for years and years, you know. And we didn't realize it. Our health was an issue then. Surgeon diagnosed me as having cancer. He had to take all my rectum, part of my colon.
Now Kenton Wamsley has to live with an ostotomy bag attached to his stomach. He changes it day and night. At the factory, he worked in a team with 3 other technicians.
My buddies, people I really love, seen them every day, cared about them. Those guys are all dead, and I should have been. They didn't even see retirement, none of them.
Wamsley and his colleagues were never warned about the risks of C8. However, we procured a confidential document from DuPont. It's dated 1982, 34 years ago. In it, Mr. Rector at the time expresses concern about the consequences of C8 retained in the blood of employees. He specifically recommends that practical steps be taken to reduce this exposure.
All employees, not just Teflon area workers, are exposed. So rather than to do anything, they just wrote it out. I've never seen a letter like that. I'm mad. You can see why. We could have prevented a lot of lies if they would have told us there's a problem. Why'd they cover it up? Why'd they lie? Why didn't they have us protected? Too costly?
We track down Bruce Carr, DuPont's former medical director. He is now enjoying a peaceful retirement by the ocean, far from Parkersburg.
I have a document of 1982 showing that you were aware that C8 was toxic for workers. Why have you not told them the truth at that time?
They were all told the truth. They were told everything we knew at the time.
Actually, no. I have interviewed some employees and they were not aware of anything.
We told employees everything we knew as soon as we knew it. You go back to 1982, you're trying to do reconstructions, history, and you can't do that.
Why have you not protected your employees? Il a raccroché.
DuPont would not only put their employees in danger. Once again, tens of thousands of people would be affected. They live up to 70 kilometers away from the factory. One man would discover this, a bit by accident. Joe Kiger. On October 31st, 2000, he receives a letter from the municipality concerning the quality of the tap water. It mentions C8.
I was sitting in my courtyard, and the wife was watering the flowers, and we got our water bill in the mail, and with that bill came a letter. It's like you get form letters all the time. So you look and say, oh, okay, bang. You put it over, and you don't think about it. Next thing you know, you throw it away. And that's basically what this was. It just caught my attention, and I started reading through it, and then the flag started popping up. First of all, what was C8 here, mm-hmm. which is used by DuPont Works? Well, what's DuPont have to do with our water?
Joe Kiger sought clarification on the matter.
I called DuPont to try to find out. So they put me in touch with a guy, a gentleman named Mr. Kennedy. And I said, you know, I'd like to know more about this C8 issue. He just told me it's nothing to worry about. About it was just a byproduct of Teflon, and it wasn't anything to worry about. And he was flat out lying to me, I could tell that.
To get to the bottom of it, he takes DuPont to court. After a long legal battle, the judge forces the company to declassify their internal studies on C8. Joe Kiger discovers the truth behind the factory at Parkersburg. For decades, they've been dumping C8 waste into the river. To make things worse, DuPont has known since 1984 that the molecule spread into the region's tap water. The company found astronomical levels in public taps, up to 50 times the limit of toxicity, according to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency.
That was 1984, and we didn't come out till 2000.
So 16 years.
Yeah, before we even hit them up about it. And they chose, as you see right here, they chose not to do anything about it. And they knew what was coming with the liabilities if they got caught. They were trying to slide under the radar. People trusted DuPont for so long. They have done nothing but lie for years to people about what this stuff's all about. There's sick people out here because of what they've done. There's people dying because of what they've done.
During all these years, more than 70,000 people have been drinking contaminated water. In 2011, both scientific research and the U.S. justice system established that C8 could cause six diseases: thyroid disorder, high cholesterol, ulcerative colitis, high blood pressure, kidney cancer, or testicular cancer. Today, 3,500 people in the Parkersburg region are ill. They've all filed complaints against DuPont. This is the case for Earl and Gwen Botkin.
I've had ulcerative colitis for about 17 years, and it's about killed me a couple times. I still have thyroid problem, and I have high cholesterol. And those are all associated with C8.
Today, Earl Botkin doesn't have a colon anymore. He, too, is living with an ostomy bag.
So all of a sudden, you don't function normally, but you have your bowel movement on your side. And that's what I live with until I die. And there's not any hope of that's going to change. It controls where I go, what I do, and what I eat. And just controls a lot of things in my life. But anyway, I lived through that.
A document reveals that all of these victims could have been spared. On May 22, 1984, a meeting took place at the DuPont headquarters. The directors are worried about the consequences for the inhabitants. They plan to eliminate all C8 emissions. But finally, no measures are taken. Their argument, it's not economically attractive.
That was in what year?
84. That's before we were married. That's a long time ago. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Long, long time ago.
That's crazy. That's what makes it so bad, you know, that they had evidence all along and just disregarded it and kept doing what they were doing.
It was company greed that caused this whole situation. They knew what they were doing to us, and they continued to do it before money. That's the only reason they continued to do it.
DuPont refuses to collectively compensate the 3,500 sick people. They prefer to study the cases one by one. As a result, since 2012, only one victim has been able to get a trial. DuPont was sentenced to pay her $1.6 million. The 3,499 remaining victims, like Earl Botkin, are still waiting. At the current pace of the trials, the last one would take place in 100 years.
Do you still trust and you're still confident that you will get a trial at some point?
Oh.
It lives long enough.
It's probably up to be 150, I'm right. There will be a trial someday. But the chances of me living long enough to ever see that are probably slim to none. But we're just another document, another number of cases to be tried. DuPont has made billions of dollars. I think they should stand up to what they've done and make it right with the people they've made sick.
DuPont refused all of our requests for an interview, so we drove to their headquarters in Delaware on the East Coast to convince them to answer our questions. At the other end of the line, we reach the head of media relations, Daniel Turner.
We are doing a documentary piece. The best way is, you know, we meet and to make a proper interview, you know, at some point. But first, let's meet. You know, I'm just here.
We'll respectfully decline the on-camera interview. I will provide you with a statement.
You know, there is like an incredible amount of documents showing that you have known at DuPont for the past 30 years that C8 was toxic. And you know that you were poisoning your employees at the Washington Works plant and the Parkersburg Citizen. Why are you not recognizing the fact that you have deliberately poisoned thousands of persons?
Okay, so are those the questions you're asking?
Yeah, this is my questions.
Okay, I'll be happy to provide with our statement.
Today, we are in 2016. There are still 3,500 persons with severe disease that are waiting to just have the right to get a trial. I mean, for how long are you going to deny your responsibility? Are you waiting that they all die?
So, we will provide you with a statement for your piece.
Nothing else? No?
Like I said, we will provide you with a statement. Thanks so much. Have a good day. Bye.
Bye.
We did receive a press release from DuPont, but without a single word for the victims. They claim to have studied C8 carefully for decades and affirm to have always acted responsibly. In 2015, DuPont finally stopped using C8. The company was also ordered by the courts to clean up the region. But how many generations are still to experience the after effects of this contamination? In the chemical world, history inexorably tends to repeat itself. It takes decades to reveal the truth, and just as many years for the multinationals to be prosecuted. In their laboratories, new toxic molecules are constantly being developed. But in 10, 20, 30, or 40 years, who knows how many new victims will be poisoned?